Welcome, everyone. For people at the back, there are some seats up front. There are quite a number of seats up front, so you're welcome to come, and there are seats on the sides, and you're welcome to sit there. For those of you who are town hall junkies, you'll notice that we're going to depart from the usual drill today somewhat. I'm going to say a little bit about the order of events right at the beginning. The principal is going to be talking about the task force on diversity, excellence, and community engagement, and then opening up the conversation. And so so that the conversation can flow from the principal's presentation to questions and comments, I'm going to give a little bit of just some ground rules right now. My job after the principal's presentation will be to keep the conversation going, to keep the discussion going, to try to ensure that as many people as possible do have a chance to express themselves. We want to hear from everyone, faculty, students, administrative and support staff, and so we're going to try to make sure that all voices are heard. We're going to try to ask you to keep your comments and your questions brief so that we can get as many in as possible. When we do have questions and comments, we're going to ask you to go to one of the microphones, even if your voice could be heard in this lovely space, which it might not be, but even if it could be, we'd ask you to go to the microphone because we are live streaming the event and we want people who may be watching online to be able to hear what you have to say. Please feel free to use either French or English, on parle de langue ici. And when you do make a comment or a question, please start off by identifying yourself with your name and the unit, academic or administrative unit, with which you identify. And so now I'm going to turn the proceedings over to the principal.
Merci, bonjour, bienvenue tout le monde. C'est vraiment un plaisir pour moi encore d'être ici pour une town hall, une guilloise. We do have four seats up front here and a number coming around the corner for those of you who are standing at the side of the back. Please feel free to come up and use them. It also brings me closer to you in the interactions. As Professor Mendelsohn said, this is a bit of an atypical town hall in that I will be using some formal notes because it does have a formal consultation dimension to it. I think we have an hour and a half, is that right? And so if we don't use all of the time on the task force, I'm very happy to treat the latter part of it as we would any town hall where any range of issues, questions, guidance are offered. Let me just say again what a privilege and special opportunity it is for me as principal to be able to hold these town halls, and I want to thank you for coming out on a gloomy Friday afternoon, but into these beautiful quarters in the library. And I want to thank our new Dean of Libraries, Dean Colleen Cook, for opening the place up to us, and thank you to you and your team and to the students who may be working away on essays and the like and feel slightly dislocated by our presence here today. I'm very happy we've got a great turnout. We had a town hall earlier at McDonald campus and on the same theme and on other issues. And one of the challenges that I face and we face as a senior leadership team in the university is that we have a community of roughly 50,000 people day in, day out, to say nothing of our 200,000 plus alumni here and around the world, our many partners out in the community and nationally and internationally. And so communication is the biggest challenge, and notwithstanding social media and all of the new tools that we have to communicate, I find, and I know the provost and the deputy provost and others do as well, that there is never enough opportunity to really hear from you, to talk about things from the point of view of our own mandate and responsibilities, and to have a sense of collectivity. And when you look at what happened in Japan in the wee hours for us this morning, and indeed we have students and faculty and alumni there with whom we've been in touch over the morning or seeking to be in touch with, you see what happens in a nation that has a very strong communitarian culture at its heart, and the enormous number of warming stories coming out moment by moment in relation to the way strangers are caring for each other as much as they would their own family members, and reaching out with a sense of collective responsibility. And that is, at its heart, what a university is all about. And so these town halls are very important for us as the McGill community in responding to both that opportunity and that imperative. Today, as Professor Mendelson said, and I did, we're going to start our town hall with me saying some formal words, and so atypically I have some written notes on the backdrop to the town hall, or to the task force, excuse me, the goals and purposes of it. And I'm assuming that you've all had a chance to read the report that is out there. And it's you might think of it as a penultimate form of the report. So we're doing a series of consultations that will finalize our recommendations. But we very much welcome your input on it. And for those of you who may be watching online or here but not making a verbal contribution, we hope the whole community will take advantage of this consultative period to give us give us your input. And there is a website for the task force that allows you to interact with us in that regard. I also want to thank the many members of the task force who have come out today, to begin by thanking you for the extraordinary work that you did. This is a labor of commitment and affection for the institution, not more than that. And I've never seen in a community where we see enormous dedication across the board, I've never seen the kind of engagement and commitment that all of the task force members and our staff around the task force have shown, as we've seen with this, because these are complex processes. So let me just say a few words about it, and I'll try and be very crisp so that we can spend the majority of our time in exchange. The task force was formed to assess and form concrete strategies for making improvements in the important areas of diversity, excellence, and community engagement. And one of the things that you'll have seen if you've read the task force report and a number of the submissions to it, and indeed in our purpose, is we don't see these concepts as independent but as integrally linked. And if we thought that might be the case going into the task force, I think our work, our research, our consultations really reinforced just how important that was. This was an administrative group. It was ad hoc, formed by me. I drew on membership from across our two campuses, faculty, administrators, students, alumni. But there was no notion of having constituency representation on it by constituency. It was more seeking people who've expressed interest, had experience in these areas, and who would bring these perspectives to bear in relation to each other rather than stand alone. We began our work in the fall of 2009. Working groups were created to consider and develop reports and recommendations relevant to our task force mandate, which I won't review again. It's quite detailed, but it's there online. We looked very closely at what peer institutions, particularly in Canada and the United States, were doing to see how they approached these issues. During our call for consultations and input and briefs from across our university, we received over 60 briefs, and we convened panels at which 24 authors of submissions were invited to come and further expand upon their work and to ask their reports or their recommendations. Let me say that in doing our research one of the things we've learned from the universities that have undertaken special measures to advance diversity, excellence, and community engagement is that at the start of such a process, there's a lot of anxiety, particularly in the research-intensive universities, that there may be a hidden agenda about distorting standards, for example, in the way the university operates, that if you think about community engagement and you think about diversity, that somehow automatically the processes and standards, most of all, for the way we develop our pedagogy, for the way we recruit our academic staff, for the way we recruit and enroll students, will somehow suffer from a quality perspective. And one of the gratifying things that we've learned is that quite the opposite happens. It brings a richer texture, a broader engagement to maintaining high standards from an academic and research and scholarly point of view, but to enriching the ways in which we do that. The recommendations of the task force now come forward for these kinds of consultations and give us an opportunity to build strategically upon some of our most characteristic strengths as an institution. One of the things that we found early on, to our great pleasure and a little bit our consternation, was the wide, wide variety of community outreach activities taking place across our two campuses and out into our affiliated hospitals and other community agencies. And we have a number of examples, but maybe one that will be top of mind for you because we just celebrated it is the Faculty of Dentistry's outreach. We've long had a mobile clinic for those who are particularly either homeless or because of their life circumstances not in a position to have regular dental care. And that has been a contribution of our students, our staff, and our alumni at the dental clinic. But we just recently announced, to our great pleasure, a new partnership with the Wellcome Mission to have a permanent dental clinic there that will be open to all of the clientele of the Wellcome Mission. But as I say, this was one of hundreds of initiatives that we've identified across the campuses, and so the consternation came because we had to ask ourselves, how come we don't know about these? Certainly the community out there doesn't, but we don't seem to know ourselves about the range of activities taking place, and that leads then to a lack of ability to build on these, to learn from the various pilot projects and programs underway, what works, what doesn't, and sometimes to, in working with community groups, find ways of dovetailing other initiatives that might be mutually helpful into those relationships. And so one of the things we want to do, of course, is find ways of making known to our community those activities. There was absolute agreement and a common theme that our campuses need to be more physically accessible as a high priority. That's been a challenge to us. It was certainly something marked for me coming here 8 years ago, that this campus is on a hill in a range of historic and older buildings. And so the whole campus was designed and built up. Its foundation was long before issues of mobility and access were front and center. I think the imperative was to get the campus built. But we're now in 2011, and it was a strong view that we simply must make accessibility a very high priority, and so some of the recommendations you'll see feed into that theme. The set of recommendations are aimed at growing our excellence consistent with our mission, enhancing and better recognizing individual and institutional performance, making our community as welcoming and supportive as it can be, and strengthening our relationships with and our contributions to the broader community in Montreal and Quebec, but also across the country and internationally, and to increasing the impact and the learning of these initiatives as they take place. And let me say here that there has been from the beginning We have a little coughing going on. I'm glad to see that we're not standing in the way. So the idea is here not that McGill is going to go out and act on any community or any group, but rather that we would build the partnerships and collaborations that would really facilitate the mutual benefits that come out of a greater community engagement and an engagement with a broader group of communities. The report includes a very precise statement that describes how diversity and excellence are linked. That is not contradictory, but mutually inclusive when we think of them together. And the task force developed three bundles of recommendations, if I can call them those, each with a series of measures that will have a contribution to make both on the academic and the non-academic elements of life. So again, I'm talking about the broad overarching three recommendations, not the all the details underneath them, but just to remind you of them. The first recommendation is that we will, as a university, demonstrate a firm commitment to the recruitment, retention, and professional development of diverse and excellent academic staff, administrative and support staff, and students, placing a strong emphasis on expanding the candidate pools and the pipelines, if you will, of future candidates to accelerate progress in moving that area forward. So let me say at this moment, it's probably the right one to say it, at no point did we, as a task force, embrace the notion of affirmative action as the way to realize progress for our university. We really thought that our major goal would be to make sure that those who could be qualified for these positions had a route into our application and enrollment procedures, whether at the staff or the student side, that would make us easy to interact with. So I'm not going to go into all the detail there. The second broad recommendation is that our definition of excellence at McGill shall be broadened to ensure that the indicators of excellence that we value and with which we measure ourselves correspond with our mission, including as part of our mission, our broad commitment to positive societal impact. We've long moved away from the notion of our university as an ivory tower, if we ever held that notion, and the fact that we're founded on a faculty of medicine and professional school means that from our very origins we were interacting in a service-oriented way with the community, but to actually formalize the notion of our commitment to positive societal impact as part of our mission. And then the third broad area was to affirm a commitment to McGill's positive engagement with and impact on outside communities, locally, nationally, and globally, building innovatively and progressively on the university's history of service to society, and thereby expanding opportunities. So this, you say, how is this different from recommendation two? This is the point. Expanding opportunities for research, scholarship, and learning. So bringing the benefits of community engagement not just to our mission to have positive societal impact, but bringing the benefits of that back into the university at the heart of our core mission. And so these were the three broad areas. I'm going to just finish saying a little bit about the consultation process. The report has now been reviewed by the senior administration, chairs and directors of departments and units. We've had an exchange on it at Senate. It'll go to the Board of Governors later this month. We've had a town hall out at the McDonald campus. We're having this one today. At each of the meetings so far, we've had an open and productive and collegial discussion, which has allowed us to improve, really sharpen the clarity of what it is that we're working to encompass within our overall report and the recommendations per se. As with the first task force under this administration, that on student life and learning, these recommendations, once they've been refined through this consultative process, will then go to the provost and his team for a formal administrative response back. And that will, as with the task force on student life and learning, set the commitments that the administration undertakes in relation to those recommendations. And it would be our view that when that report comes out, we would have another opportunity to say what then will be the obligations of the university going forward to meet those goals that the provost and the provostial group take on. Let me just say that we're aiming for an aggressive timeline. We've taken 18 months to get to this point, and we're really wanting to see the administrative response come back in the fall and with implementation beginning as soon as possible. And if you access the full report, what you'll see in the appendices is many, many other recommendations that were made to the task force, some of which can and are being acted on in real time. So we have our three major recommendations, which we view to be substantial in terms of saying we want to do some things differently or with more focus and commitment institutionally than we have to this point. But there are many things of an administrative nature, of an educational nature, of a campus's life nature, that groups can simply take up and start implementing, and we would urge you to do that. So I think I'll just say that I hope that'll be the final point on this, that whatever input you give us today or online, you'll think carefully, each and every one of you, about what you can be doing to enhance the interface of diversity, excellence, and community engagement in our university in a way that reflects our noble mission, but also reflects our commitment to being a progressive institution of learning, research, and scholarship, serving locally, nationally, and internationally, positioning us for the next 50 years as well as we've been positioned for the last 50 and indeed 190 years. So I think I'll stop there and turn it back to you, Professor Mendelson, and open it to the floor.
Okay. So I invite people to come forward to the microphones. Feel free to line up if you feel that you're going to want to make a comment. And just a reminder to please identify yourself by name and where you work or study in the university.
Hello, I'm Kevin Whitaker. I'm the president of MENACA, representing the non-academic support staff here at McGill. And I'd just like to ask, one of the main topics addressed in the task force is employment equity. Now, under the federal government's federal contractor program, McGill is required to consult and collaborate with employee representatives and or bargaining associations in all employment equity implementation. And I'd like to know why there were no employee association representatives on this task force.
Well, as I said in my opening, no special group was targeted for membership. This was a membership appointment by me on an individual basis.
So it doesn't encompass employment equity?
That's not the point. Okay. The point was diversity, excellence, and community engagement writ large, and it was an ad hoc task force that I appointed of individuals to work with these with me on these issues, not from a particular interest or point of view, but thinking about the university as a whole. We have many avenues for you to pursue these particular issues, and I'd urge you to take those up.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm Vicki Cook from ISR. I've worked at McGill for 19 years, and I was a student before that, so I feel very engaged with McGill. And I'm wondering whether diversity in staff... I'm a little nervous, okay. I'm being reminded to slow down here. I'm wondering if this task force, these recommendations, would apply to our staff recognition programs. Although, as I said, I've worked here for 19 years, I'm only credited with having worked here for 13 years because the first six were as a casual. I replaced people on mat leave or on study leave. And so I'm wondering if you're going to embrace that kind of diversity and recognize that service can be from people from a different background, not just permanent staff.
Well, let me say, I think we have many measures that do recognize that. And, of course, we appreciate and value that greatly. The focus here is on the work that the task force did and the recommendations that came out. And so if you have ways that you feel the recommendations embody that or could, we would welcome your particular recommendations.
So I should send them to the
Yeah, to the website.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Salim Razak from Medicine.
Do you want to say what your...
I'm the Assistant Dean of Admissions, Equity, and Diversity in the Faculty of Medicine. And that's been kind of an evolution in the job from admissions to admissions, equity, and diversity. So we're very much aligned in terms of the recommendations from this task force.
And thank you for your contributions to reflections of the task force.
What I am interested in is, it's sort of in there, but implicitly, is this notion that attracting diversity, dealing with equity, thinking of equity, also affects our curriculum, curricula, in probably very positive ways, because there's lots of literature that show that that there are changes to the conversations that occur when you change your student population. And I'm just wondering how we are thinking of that, and how we are thinking of perhaps even tracking that, or looking at that.
Well, here you know from your own interaction with us as one of the presenters to the task force that this is an area that we are very engaged with, and there are a range of recommendations under those three areas that speak to the very issue that you've raised. I think one of the questions will be what will be the administrative response to the recommendations, and how will they be expressed in the development of curriculum, pedagogical approaches overall, the tools that we use to enhance the teaching and learning experience and to do it from the perspective of diversity, excellence, and community engagement. And so I'd say again, if you have particular measures that you think ought to be considered in that light, please do send them in. But I think we will look then to the administrative response to lay out a little bit how that fits into the academic planning process, how the academic planning process might change to accommodate the recommendations that have come forward and the goals that have been outlined in the task force.
Thank you very much.
But just when I say each and every one of us will have a role to play in this, I urge each of you to use your roles here to make sure that we're moving assertively in those directions.
I guess
you've certainly got one to do that.
I think the one last comment that I'll make is that I think that underneath even that is this idea of not dichotomizing between excellence and diversity and equity.
Well, that
really
was
bringing it all together. Which
that
is,
was the goal to bring them together. And as I said, one of the things that was quite interesting in both reading about the processes other universities have been through and meeting with some of the people who've been through it is that this was a big anxiety for the research-intensive universities where our reputation is so dominantly based on our, you know, benchmarked performance criteria in scholarship and research in particular and the quality of our students. And to say that, in fact, all of that becomes richer and more able to make a contribution through our particular mission if we bring diversity but also community engagement in together with our pursuit of excellence, which is in our DNA and powerful, and not to be worried that we're going to lose the commitment to excellence in doing that.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Hi, my name is Laura Risk. I'm a graduate student in musicology. Am I too close to the mic?
No, that's good.
All right. We actually spoke last week. I'm a member of the PGSS Family Care Committee, and we had spoken last week at the PGSS meeting about family care issues, and so I wanted to bring some of those to the attention of the task force. I was very pleased to see in this draft report this that there is some mention of families at McGill. This one bit really struck out where it says, this is page 8. McGill should also develop measures to support not simply the retention but also the flourishing of students and academic, administrative, and support staff from a variety of backgrounds. And then it goes on to mention instituting programs that encourage a positive work-life balance, as well as increased support for those with family obligations and those taking parental leave. But I did notice the recommendations that follow that don't actually mention students who have families. They do treat faculty and staff who have families. But there are a number of students who have families, including myself. You probably heard my daughter screaming there in the background. And I'd just like to say, I think really there's three issues here that would be particularly relevant to families. One of them is the question of just recognition. So you do say one of the recommendations is to establish benchmarks for diversity and collect relevant information. I think it's important to collect information about families at McGill so we know how many students have children, how many faculty members have children, staff members. And we're also currently we're working on drafting a set of guidelines in terms of accommodation, academic accommodation for families who have, for students who have children and may, for instance, miss an exam because their child is sick. How do we deal with situations like that? A second question, I think, is integration into the community. And I like the emphasis in the task force report on outreach to the community. And I would say, in a certain way, student families embody outreach. Yeah. And what we need is inreach. Mm-hmm. We need to be integrated into the community. Student families, or students don't attend university events if they don't have childcare. They don't go to class if they don't have childcare. And so we would be interested in, well, or they bring their children to campus. So we'd be interested in some material support on campus, changing tables, nursing areas, maybe spaces in the libraries or public spaces where children can play for a few minutes while their parents do what they need to do on campus. But we'd also be interested in some issues of childcare. This is daycare, but this is also things like family-friendly conferences. If you're hosting a conference at McGill, is there some policy about providing childcare? As a graduate student, I attend conferences when there is childcare, and I don't if there's not childcare. Mm-hmm. Or I bring my daughter and I spend the whole time in the hallway. Mm-hmm. So, you know, how do we deal with these issues to make this? I think this is an accessibility issue, mm-hmm. And I'd like to also say that the PGSS, the Family Care Committee. We're not asking McGill to provide these resources. We're not sitting here waiting for you to provide them, but we would like to work with McGill to figure out how to integrate student parents. And let me say one more thing about daycare, because I know daycare is a big issue. It's a big issue in Montreal. It's a big issue in Quebec. It's on the front page of the paper all the time. There are not enough daycare spots. There are not enough daycare spots at McGill. And we know that McGill is not in the daycare business. But I think we have to reframe daycare. The question of daycare is not simply childcare. Daycare is an accessibility issue. So McGill is not in the business of elevators, mm-hmm. but we provide elevators so that the campus can be accessible. And I think childcare is really about making the campus accessible to students. I'll just say that I finished my master's degree last summer. I'm in the PhD now. And I finished the master's degree with three half days of childcare per week. That was what I could find. In other words, any class I wanted to take had to be Monday, Wednesday, or Friday morning between 9 and 12, because that's what I had. I did it. I finished my master's. But I did all my homework at the playground. If there was some way to figure out some sort of part-time childcare or full-time childcare, I think that would be one way of really integrating the student parents here at McGill and bringing that, letting that diversity be a part of it. The campus.
Thank you very much for your very eloquent and well-taken points. You make recommendations in a couple of categories, and I would say that without a question, the goals that you're espousing are our goals, and I think they're pretty clearly articulated in the task force report. So how do we get from here to there? And
yes.
You and other colleagues at the PGSS meeting who also have children and little children certainly spoke to the demands on you and the extraordinary challenges that you face. So, again, we'll go back to the administrative response, and we're taking notes on all of the comments that come in here and through other elements of consultation. But I was very struck when you said when we met last week that there aren't change tables in our washrooms.
There is one changing table on campus.
So
student service point.
So there are those kinds of things which you might think about as a one-time support to making our spaces better for supporting those who have young children here. Mm-hmm. The issue of daycare is a huge one, and as much as Quebec feels like a tough place, I believe it's true, Quebec has the most progressive family care policies in the country.
Yes, I would agree with that.
And I was certainly in Ontario when a move was made to go in the direction of Quebec that got defeated totally. So I think I like the very much your own commitment to moving forward with these issues, whatever happens. I believe I can speak for my colleagues on the senior team, share your commitment to making this a place that feels accessible and supportive for those with families. You know, I have a different view on childcare. That is, having been in other places that have tried to do this and failed at it with fewer constraints than we have, both financially and from a space point of view, that I believe the mechanism for us is to really work with government and neighborhoods to have a broader distribution of appropriate available daycare. One of the things that I think we've underused in the university as a whole, but has been expressed very well in certain pockets, this is one of those great examples of creativity at the local level that no one knows about. The Newman House, in its work with our international student body, many of whom are graduate students, uses volunteers very extensively to support the ability for student parents to participate by having childcare for children available. And I like your notion of setting some goals with respect to our academic conferences and other initiatives that we have. Mm-hmm. And I think we've underexplored the opportunity of partnering with our undergraduate students on a volunteer basis to support those activities. But these are some of the initiatives that we can certainly look at going forward.
Okay.
I'm not going to make this the theme of the meeting, but we are underfunded. And so there are a whole lot of good ideas that we would like to engage that we just simply can't say, great idea, we're going to buy in the support for. So we've got to work creatively, and it will mean some investment of resources, and we came into the task force with an understanding that there would be a requirement, but that we would also go to some of our alumni to see if we could get gifts for certain initiatives. And I think in the notion of a community engagement with this, that volunteerism will play a role as well. So it's not going to be all one or another, and I saw quite powerfully last week the extent to which you and other members of PGSS are, you know, walking the walk in what you're doing.
Maybe I could just add to that that the Family Care Committee and the PGSS does have a budget.
Yeah.
We don't have enough probably to pay for child care for everyone on campus, but we do, for instance, have some money set aside for changing tables. But we can't go put those changing tables in ourselves.
Right.
Or this has to come from the university. But we are willing to work together, not just in a general way of supporting it, but we are actually willing to financially contribute because we do have some budget for that.
Yeah.
And the same would go for nursing areas or making spaces, public spaces where children are
welcome. Well, I see our
associate
vice principal, Professor Nysel, is here, who is in charge of these facilities. I don't know, Jim, if you wanted to say a word on that. I love the action. I just love that. Thank you very much for those comments and contributions.
My name is Dr. Anne McCauley, and I'm director of a center called Participatory Research at McGill. And I want to thank you for undertaking this whole enterprise, and especially for including the idea of greater community engagement. And especially I would like to support you in your comments. I walked in to hear you saying that there are concerns among some members of McGill that if you engage community in a research process, that in some way this would diminish the scientific integrity of your research. And I would like to ensure people that the whole philosophy of participatory research and engaging communities and using that to increase knowledge translation, because you have everybody at the table together, is absolutely imperative to maintain very high levels of scientific integrity. It's important for the researcher. It's also important for those people that you engage in the research process who are at the table together, because shoddy research doesn't benefit anybody.
From my own research career, have a very concrete example of that in the field of psychiatric epidemiology. When back in the 80s, we were looking at getting population-based input to ascertain the prevalence of childhood and adolescent psychiatric disorder in the general population. When we went to work with First Nations peoples, they insisted on being partners in the research process, and that was not a tradition at the time. And in fact, the whole methodology had been set up and not funded with that as an idea. So we did a pilot project that made special changes in the way we worked in order to capture that input. But we did it, I must say honestly, somewhat as a sense of obligation in order to get First Nations people to participate so we could understand more about them. Well, one of the disorders that was being looked at the time was conduct disorder. And when we sat down with the elders to look at the results of the pilot study done with First Nations people, the first thing that the scientific team said was, my gosh, there's this incredible prevalence of conduct disorder amongst First Nation children, but particularly adolescents. And the elders said, well, that's not our experience. Let's look at how that happened. And it turned out that on the conduct disorder inventory, fire setting is one of the indicators. Well, it turned out that all of the young people in the community who would be viewed to be the leaders in the community were the ones who showed up as having conduct disorder because they had the special privilege of being involved in the fire lighting ceremony. So if you ever needed an example of why partnership is a good idea when you're looking at issues that affect other people, that stood as a powerful one for me.
Yeah, I mean, this is exactly why CHR and SHRC and all the major funding agencies are now spending many more millions, NIH is spending many more millions of dollars in supporting all forms of partner research because they too believe in it, and the peer review process is as tough as it is for any researcher-driven process. So thank you very much.
I can hear Morton behind me saying stop talking so long and let's let others speak. So that's to me, not to you. So.
Hello?
Yeah.
Hi. I'm Emily. I'm the SMU Equity Commissioner. So I wanted to thank you first off for doing the task force. It's very important. But when I was reading it, a few things kind of came up. I was looking at the list of people who participated in it, and it only seems like there were 3 students that were consulted. I wanted to know how you selected these students and why. Mm-hmm. Further, I have another question after that. Is that okay?
Let me just repeat what I said, that we consulted the whole community. So there was nothing to prevent the entire student body from making submissions, and many students did make representation.
Okay.
But the members were not chosen on the basis of constituency groups.
Okay.
But there was great student contribution to the.
All right.
But real fast on your second one.
All right. And also, when I was reading through the report, I was kind of surprised that the terms discrimination, racism, anti-oppression were never mentioned throughout the whole entire report. If you're trying to engage in diversity, I feel that it's really important to recognize the issues that come with diversity and make sure that there are mechanisms to ensure that students are protected and staff as well. Mm-hmm. Further, there are also different forms of discrimination. I know Professor Mendelson did a great report on discrimination, and he reported it to council, which was great. But there are different forms of discrimination as well. There's overt and systemic, and there are different manifestations of it. And in a report about diversity, I feel that it's extremely important that this is fully represented.
Yeah. Thank you for the point. In fact, we tried to use language in the report that would engage everybody and not create defensiveness. And so there was a broad acknowledgement, and many of the submissions, if you've had a chance to look at them, talk about the various forms of barrier to participation of diverse groups, to promotion of those who come in from different kinds of backgrounds. But we really wanted to use a language that was not accusatory and creating defensiveness, but rather language that would have us acknowledging the challenges that are there, but very fact-based in the way we approached it. So I agree with you that there are many, many forms and frankly many, many situations that lead to whether or not people feel like this is part of their environment, and we will be coming back to these.
Okay. Well, I just want to make one final point. Discrimination is a reality for many people in India, and it's important to be upfront about it.
Yeah. We agree totally with that, and that could be said for society at large as well. And so the more we take responsibility for engaging in ways that create a sense of inclusiveness and participation, the better off we'll be.
Thank you, Madam Principal, for coming here. My name is Kahal Rooney Sestries, political science and economics, currently Smooth Speaker Council, and I represent McGill on the Malta UN circuit. My question is, well, I'll preface by saying that one of the most common complaints amongst incoming students, current students, and alumni is that when you get accepted to McGill, you don't really feel like you guys really want us. That's, you know, when you line up all the acceptance letters, you get the McGill acceptance envelope, and then you get the full package from many other universities. And one could argue that this has a two-pronged negative effect. First is that it disattracts many students from coming here, so I guess affecting the excellence portion of today's meeting. And then it doesn't, for those who do come, it doesn't really feel like, or sets the tone for not really feeling welcome at this university.
What kinds of measures of redress would you propose?
Basically sending out an admissions package that is comparable to the other universities.
You mean financially? Or you mean in other respects? And what I need you to be precise, just to understand.
Yeah, just like, because when you're accepted to McGill, you get like a pretty small envelope, and there's like a lot of bureaucratic paperwork. Mm-hmm. While at other universities, it's a bit more superficial, where everybody at the university is good looking, it's very colorful, and you feel a lot more welcome. So
you're suggesting we go that route? I think it's a pretty good looking group here.
Perhaps, and as somebody who's also fundraised for McGill and spoken to a lot of McGill alumni,
yeah.
I can definitely say that people don't really feel as if the university tries to institute this sort of sense of community. And that admissions letter, if anything, sets the tone for that feeling. So,
okay. Well, I hear you on the letter.
Yeah.
And so thank you for that. And that's something we've got the deputy provost who oversees admissions here to hear that as well. There are a number of measures that have been taken just in the last couple of years, and it goes back to volunteerism. Our alumni are playing a powerful role now in reaching out, not just locally, but in other communities in which they're located, to those who've been admitted, to have welcoming orientation sessions, our tents on campus during Frosh Week and so forth. But I'll be the first to admit there are many more things we can do. And the other thing I hear often is just the time to hearing is something that has people, particularly outside of Quebec, sitting on tenterhooks waiting to hear if they're in or not. And there are complicated reasons for that, given the way grades flow in Quebec for our Quebec students or applicants. But these are important. How it starts is important.
Okay. And if I could just finish by saying, I can definitely say that, well, I can probably imagine that the Student Society, as well as the various undergraduate faculty associations, would love to collaborate on a project like this. So.
Yeah, but you can collaborate, but you also have a huge mechanism yourself to welcome students, right?
That's true.
So we do a lot in collaboration. In fact, we had a meeting with two members of your executive this morning to talk about exactly this. But I would say every one of us shouldn't feel like we're not reaching out to people and making them feel welcome. This is each of our responsibility as well as an institutional undertaking.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Hi, my name is Jax Cheng, and I'm one of the executive directors for Diversity Alliance, which is a student initiative that came out of the Seed Lead program. And the issue that I want to highlight here is about communication. One of the biggest problems, I think, in terms of the Diversity Alliance trying to achieve what it's trying to do to provide a mutual learning and education platform for students, staff, and the administration, is that the McGill community is quite segregated in the sense that there's not a constant flow of communication between the different constituents of the community. And that one of the things that I noticed from the report is that there seems to be there's not a highlight of the feedback mechanism or the interconnectivity of the efforts, meaning that it seems like the efforts are quite unilateral in the sense that, yes, the administration is trying to do all these things and, you know, we're trying to implement all these things for the better, the greater good of the community, but we're not taking back from what's going on in the community. And, like, let's say that these measures are implemented. Are we, you know, getting feedbacks from people? Are things working out? Are we communicating with each other in terms of what people are doing? A lot of times, that is the more important part of creating diversity, is that talking about diversity in a much broader term than to just focus on specific issues and forget that there is a bigger picture to take care of.
Yeah, well, it's a great point, and it may speak to a weakness in the way we express the work of the task force, because so much of our discussion was on, you know, that continuous, you put it well, kind of feedback loop in all directions. And the most striking example to us was the fact that we simply didn't know how many great things were going on our two campuses by way of community outreach or even outreach within our community. There was a lot of discussion in the task force about, so the goal of that feedback loop is absolutely a goal. And if it's not clear enough, we need to make it clear. There will be many, many mechanisms for achieving that, not just one. But there was a notion that there are certain places where responsibility should be vested for taking a broad look across the university and saying, you know, we're doing well according to the goals we're setting ourselves or we're not. One example would be the physical accessibility goal. You know, our building and property committee of the Board of Governors is kind of the sign-off point for all of the infrastructure development, renovation, and so forth that goes on. So if there isn't someone sitting at that table who says every time we make a decision, we're going to be looking at what the implications are for mobility and access, you could have 20 officers and it's still not going to happen. So that's an example of saying that some of the recommendations we have are not to be all-encompassing, far from it. When I keep saying every one of us has a responsibility to meet these goals, I can't say it enough. But that there are some places where we know there ought to be some responsibility for this, where even if a whole lot of others take on a role, it won't happen. And so partly it was back and forth between how best to position it, and this goes back to the question that was posed earlier about what happens after this administration, you know, if we as an administration all commit ourselves to this. And I say what's not, you know, administrations can facilitate some things or put a focus on things, but it's all of us as a community that make them happen and make them happen well. So, you know, thank you for the work that you do. One of the things we ought to do as we look to the provost and his group to have an administrative response is to actually say, how will we share information in a meaningful way? Thank you.
Hi, my name is Michał Rozwodski. I'm a graduate student in philosophy and also the vice president external of ACSEM, which is the TA union on campus. And I'd like to follow up a bit on Kevin's question about employment equity. I mean, in general, again, thank you for preparing the report. And I mean, it's generally well received. But I felt that that was one of the areas where there are outstanding commitments that aren't being dealt with. In terms of employment equity. So I'm not going to push any more on the question of how the task force participation was chosen, although I do share the opinion that's been raised by a couple other people that perhaps it should have been a bit more targeted. I see the point of it being, right, we want to look externally at the university without pressure. But on the other hand, that's a way of neglecting things as well, or
not
having certain things be...
Not when you invite everyone to make a submission, and all submissions are considered. Okay, so I just put it back to you. There has been ample opportunity in that regard.
No, and I understand that.
And we're proud of being one of Canada's top 100 employers. I think we always have room to go in that. But this is a two-way street.
Yeah, right? No, and that's nice. Sorry, that was just a means of preamble, maybe. But I'll leave that point aside. I guess my question is what kind of measures we can expect to come out of this that will ensure not only improvements and all these other nice things, but making sure that sort of the outstanding current equity commitments that the university has already made are implemented, and to have what kind of strong measures can we come out, can we see coming out of this task force just to have implementation? I mean, there's lots of examples of employing groups not being represented on relevant Senate committees, not being involved in pay equity processes in terms of drafting reports. Our own collective agreement has an article in it that stipulates the creation of employment equity guidelines at the level of the Union Management Committee that has not been touched and not been done at all. So, I mean, what can we expect as employee groups on this campus that will ensure that we're involved in sort of very tangible ways and in ways in maintaining diversity and maintaining equity as a component of diversity, right? This is important facet of diversity, not only in the future, not only in these nice initiatives, but in the realm of existing commitments.
Yeah, well, let me say, first of all, we have a very inclusive governance system for Senate and board, and peers choose peers for representation. And I don't think you want a Trump democracy in your own representation. So I'm actually very proud of the way we get representation in our two major governing bodies. I'm not here to debate, and it's not the purpose of the town hall, particulars of any one employee group's considerations, particularly where those are in a process of interaction.
It was a general question about implementation.
But we have mechanisms for implementation. We have agreements that we're committed to fulfilling, and that is our intent.
Okay. Thank you. Just a note to make sure that it's part of the planning process as you go.
Absolutely. Let me say we're not backing away from any of these engagements, right?
Hi, my name is Maria Isabelle. I'm in the French Language and Literature Department at McGill School of Environment. I've noticed for the last maybe year that McGill's administration has made effort to be more bilingual, so now we receive our message in both languages. However, I have concern about the French and English second language courses that were free and now that will not be offered for free anymore. And I know that they were very popular, and I am sure that they were greatly contributing to the integration of international students to the Montreal community and also to the Francophone student into the McGill community. We also know a recent survey done at the PGSS was showing that French is a barrier for students to stay in the community after, so they leave outside of the province. So I think that getting these free and accessible resources that was very popular is not in line with providing incentive for French acquisition language, which is part of your recommendation.
Absolutely.
For staff, for faculty members,
right,
but also for students.
Yeah.
So I wanted to know how you're going to make sure that it's equally accessible to everyone, because students are not doing these courses for credit. They're not doing it as part of their research. They're really doing it to integrate the community. So making it expensive and not affordable, I'm afraid, is not in line with the goal that you're proposing.
Well, I have a simple suggestion. This gets back to the fact that we do have limited resources and we're constantly having to make tough decisions about them. I would urge you to make representation yourselves as students to the Ministry of Education, Leisure and Sports on the importance of supporting French language preparation for students in the Anglophone universities as well as in the Francophone universities. There's a special initiative, for example, to support international students to learn French when they're coming into the Francophone universities. Why should it be different here? So you can work with us on that. Because we really, you know, our underfunding is about $100 million a year compared to the other universities with our mission in the rest of Canada, and over twice that when you go to the public universities south of the border. And yet we try and claim and try and do the things that are part of our tradition and our mission and our mandate. But we do need the government support to do this. And here's an area where we could partner hand in glove and saying, we want to do this. We've, in fact, made investments to do it, but we can't do it without fair funding from the government to support French language acquisition.
So just as a quick follow-up then, how are you planning on providing incentive for French language acquisition?
Well, I'm saying we need some more resources to provide it at the broad level that you're talking about.
Okay, thank you.
So I'd love for us to work together on that.
Thank you.
Hello, my name is Nadav Sloven, and I'm a student, undergraduate student at McGill.
What are you studying?
I'm studying economics and philosophy. I'm wondering, on the diversity section, you talk about the necessity to have diversity in economic status. And obviously, it's an extremely important facet of our community that anyone who is academically strong and is able to go to McGill can do so regardless of their economic
right.
status. Clearly, part of that is ensuring that our tuition does not increase. I'm wondering if...
You made a big leap there. You noticed that.
Might be a non sequitur. Hopefully not. I think it is. It is an important part that our tuition doesn't leap. You know, obviously small increases are important with inflation and possibly mm-hmm. even more than inflation. But we're talking about big leaps that could potentially stop a lot of students from being able to go to the school, including myself. And what I'm wondering is, as a student who doesn't have much say in this matter, whether I can really trust you to do the most you can to ensure that our tuition doesn't increase substantially, and if you're going to be a proponent of that.
Okay, well, thank you for your question. I share your goal completely. That is that all qualified students be able to come. I would argue the methodology. So Quebec has the lowest tuition fees in Canada. We have the lowest university participation rate. We have fewer of those who come from financially challenged backgrounds and who are first in their families coming to school here than in any other province. And for those who come, we have very low graduation rates. That's not the McGill story, but that's the Quebec story. So that policy, which reflects values that we embrace, and I certainly do, isn't being well served by the mechanisms of low frozen tuition, where the government can't possibly pay for the needs of students who come from financially difficult backgrounds, which go far beyond tuition. They go to housing and transportation and all these other things. So you know well what the public policy position is that I take, and it's one I've been true to for 8 years, and that is that the government's got to grow substantially its own investment in post-secondary education. It's got to grow dramatically financial support for students who don't have the resources to come to university. I think we should have support for more full-time students. There's a lot of evidence that shows that particularly those who may be the first in their families to go to university are far more likely to graduate if they can go as full-time students than they are if they are part-time students, and I think that's part of the Quebec story. We have a very high rate of part-time participation across the full system. In addition to that, you know, we've used our campaign very dramatically to begin to close the gap on student aid. I'm hoping during my time as principal we'll be able to say every qualified student can come independent of their financial circumstances, and we've gone a long way for both our undergraduate and our graduate students to closing that gap, but a gap still remains in our own financial ability to support our students. And then I would say, and you know, we can talk about the MBA in that regard if people want to, but for those who have the ability to pay and those who are most immediately going to benefit dramatically financially from their education, they ought to contribute to the best of their ability, and the Quebec system doesn't ask that. So we have the poorest families in Quebec subsidizing the middle class and the upper middle class and beyond in the current way university education is funded. So we're looking for actually more access, not less, greater government support, but also students and their families to pay a fair share where they're able to do that. Let me add one more element that is absolutely critical and more important to McGill than any other Quebec university. When our international students come here, so we have almost 20% of our student body is international. Every international student who comes from other than France pays a higher fee than anyone else in the province, and high fees by virtue of comparison with the average undergraduate fees in Canada. McGill does not get to keep that money. So the resources that you bring in, for those of you who are undergraduate international students, paying, say, $17,000, $18,000, $19,000 a year, goes into a pool that goes to fund the whole system and doesn't stay here. And I would say another point of common advocacy for us as a members of the McGill community is to say that students and their families who support someone to come here should be able to keep the resources they bring in to the benefit of their own experience. And so when you talk about some of the things we don't have that might exist at the research-intensive universities, for example, in Ontario, for welcoming students, for student services, for all of these things, it is because we are dramatically underfunded. And part of that underfunding, to the tune of tens of millions of dollars a year, is because we don't get to keep the fees that students bring in here at the university. So that should be a point on which there should be no disagreement within the community.
Thank you very much. And just a very quick point, it seems that our space is a little too limited, and our time possibly as well. Maybe next time we could dedicate a little more time and a bigger space to this.
Yeah, or one of the things we find is that the bigger space doesn't do it, but doing it more frequently might. I'm wondering if we could hear from those who haven't had a chance to speak first, and then if we have time left, we'll go to second round.
This is sort of a follow-up on his question. My name is Ryan Hughes. I'm the Vice President External of the Postgraduate Student Society, and it's a follow-up on the MBA. I recognize the fact that there may be a loss of socioeconomic diversity amongst our students, and given the fact that some of our MBA students are being used as political footballs, and so that they have their funding stripped, I'm wondering if, I know that there's an underfinancing of the university, but in this case, this special case, is there something that can be done on the university side in order to accommodate some of those students who are intellectually capable of handling the program but don't have the funds and resources to attend or at least maintain their attendance at McGill University? This is a special case, and I'm wondering what McGill can do, mm-hmm. even though they are underfinanced, in order to mm-hmm. accommodate these students.
Thank you. I welcome the question. First, let me just say a few words about how we got to where we are. To fund an MBA student at the level that we were funded before taking the program self-funded cost us, on a conservative estimate, $22,000 a year. And of that, the student would pay $2,000 and the government would give us a grant for $10,000. That left a gap of $10,000 per student in the MBA program that had to get filled. How did that get filled? By drawing on our largest undergraduate student body. That's the only place where we had any degrees of freedom. So it meant we were taking $10,000 a year per MBA student out of the resources, which are still underfunded for our undergraduate arts and sciences students, and putting that into supporting the program, and still not achieving the quality and the services that MBA programs typically offer in our public universities here in Canada. So we felt that where normally every faculty contributes to the ability of the university as a whole to have a good reputation and to contribute through education, research, and scholarship, here was a program that ought to be supporting us that was dragging us down. And so the question really comes up then, should we offer an MBA program at all? We got enormous feedback that it's hard to be a great comprehensive university without one, and we are a university with a great variety of professional programs. So the decision was taken to treat that program as a self-funded program, so we get no money from the Quebec government for it. Students who come into that program are still eligible for the loans program of Quebec, but we have, by raising the fees the way we have, done exactly the model that I was describing to the person just before you. That is, we've grown dramatically the amount of financial aid available. In fact, to the tune of 11, if you averaged it out, which we don't because students have different needs, $11,000 per student. So we're doing exactly what we aim to do, and that is to provide financial aid and to provide a higher quality of education in the MBA. And remember, this is for students who are required to have several years working before they come in, unlike our undergraduate students, and who, within 2 years of graduating, are making over $100,000 a year. So it seems to be a fair and equitable approach that is still allowing some students from financially difficult backgrounds to come and get an MBA. Okay, thank you.
Hi, my name is Guy Lifschitz. I just graduated computer science in December. I'm wondering also about implementation of this. Because it seems like, in the end, the top levels of administration have the final word on things. And if you look at the example of the Architecture Cafe as relating to the Task Force on Student Life and Learning, the administration kind of kicked the ball from Senate to Board of Governors and then in the end said, oh, actually, it's an administrative decision, a management decision, which basically meant, oh, it's our, it's up to us. And you must have known that the whole time, right? And it seems very strange to take this student issue and make it completely administrative and in this black box where no students can access what's going on the inside of the decisions. And I'm wondering, isn't that going to, how will that not happen with all these task forces?
Well, let me get back. First of all, you know that there's been tremendous exposure to the details of that decision-making, so you're being slightly duplicitous in saying it's a black box. There's been enormous communication on it. But let me just take the general point that you raise. I can't say it enough. We are responsible for the administrative response. And as with the task force on student life and learning, it's my expectation that the administration will be making at least annual reports back into our two governing bodies on whatever the commitments are that we undertake on the issue of the architecture cafe. You know there's been a consultative process set up that I hear from the student leaders is working quite effectively. There are consultation processes from a student life and learning perspective in many different domains relating to the recommendations coming out of that task force. So I do anticipate a similar framework, and the whole rationale behind my asking the provost for an administrative report and response back is so that it doesn't get deep-sixed, you know, so that we'll be on the record for saying what it is we undertake to do as the administration. But if the implementation of a changed approach to progressing McGill according to the interaction of diversity, excellence, and community engagement is not taken up by every group and every individual who makes up the community, we won't make the progress that we have. So I'm the last one to say I hope it's only in the hands of the administration to move us forward. We have a big collective opportunity to do that together.
I have a follow-up then, is if the administration doesn't follow these task forces, is there a method of recourse for students and faculty and administration and anyone else to challenge their decisions?
Senate and board every year when the reports come forward.
Okay, thanks.
And I must say, if that were the problem, I would welcome it. I would say the problem more often is people at Senate and board saying why we're not moving forward in the areas that we say. So I'd like less defensiveness on that and more engagement on change. Thank you.
Hi, my name is John Eric. I am a student in political science. I'm also the operations coordinator of McGill WalkSafe. And I was wondering why in this report there is no reference in the community outreach part to SMU, to the clubs and services, and how your community outreach strategy is compatible with your hostility towards SMU services such as McGill First Aid, McGill WalkSafe, TV McGill when concerning the McGill name.
Well, you can imagine I don't associate myself with your conclusion on that, but we've not mentioned a whole lot of groups who have to be collaborators to getting progress in the areas of having a safe and accessible university community. Thank you.
I'm tall. Hi, my name's Nancy Crow, and I am a library worker. I work here in the library. And I kind of feel like I should welcome you because I work here. You know, it's funny, eh? I do welcome you.
I just
want to be quick. I don't want to take up a lot of time. I don't know the big picture because I'm just beginning to get involved and to take an interest in university politics, right? So, but what I do know is my own little corner. And I sometimes work down here, and I'm talking. I guess I'm going to talk about physical accessibility. And I don't know how you came into this space, but if you're in a wheelchair or on crutches, you have to go through certain steps to get down here. You know, and there, I don't think I think people are aware of it. You know, I don't want to attack you. You know, but I'd like to see something done so that people don't have to come down through, you know, the staff elevator and have to hook up with the security. And, I mean, this is a new space, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I think maybe anyway. But on the flip side, because I try to be fair in my life and in my thinking, I also go as a part of my little routine. I'm a full-time person here. I love going to the Redpath Museum, right? And I go at lunch, eh? And I even put in the $5. And I for some time, I know that there's been no wheelchair access. But I asked the girl, because I wanted to be sure of my facts before I brought it up here. And she said that's coming, right? And that you're going to get an elevator in there. Mm-hmm. And she said, you know, she didn't give me a... But, you know, she's just a nice person trying to reassure me because I have friends from the community that
you
I also...
would like to bring in.
Yeah, and that's it. So I know a lot. There's a lot about money and all that, but... I mean, I'd love to talk to you. Like, I'd love to show you if you want to exit, you know, from... But I do, at the same time, appreciate... Can I ask, is that for sure about the Redpath Museum, or are they going to be...
I see Professor Nysel isn't here, but I have seen... Is that right, I think, Jim's gone?
Yes, he's gone. Okay, it's a yes.
But yes is the answer, and it's been on it. But again, to your point, you know, it's been on the books for a couple of years. What I can say is that I don't think there's a member of the task force who needs to be shown the challenges. We had some very visceral experiences of the challenges that people with mobility problems face in navigating the campus, and it's something from my own personal. Life that I take very seriously as well. To give you an example, I think, Tony, I saw you, Pico, I think $1.5 million to build the elevator in the Redpath.
Wow.
So just to give you a sense, so we are committed to it.
Yeah.
That means, though, so this is the kind of thing that you have to, beg you to understand. Every time we make a decision about where we allocate our resources, we're constrained from allocating them somewhere else. So this is an area we're saying is a priority.
Okay.
And that's where I really appreciate the spirit in which you came to the microphone and in understanding we are juggling constantly. There are 1,000 more causes we would joyfully support that we think are actually important to the place and to making it the place we most want it to be, that, you know, you do one and there's an opportunity cost for the other. The good news is that with our campaign, with the generosity of our students and our staff and our alumni, we're making great progress on these things. With some government initiatives like the Knowledge Infrastructure Fund, it's allowed us, we've had, I think by the end of this calendar year, we'll have had around $500 million in infrastructure development, dominantly on this campus, but on both campuses, in under a 5-year period. So we are making progress. This beautiful space is a great example of that, but it does make me crazy when I know we built new spaces that are not easily accessible. And so that's the recommendation that the task force took, that we build into that decision making and say this is not something that you just cross out once you've approved a project, making it accessible because we don't have enough money to do everything we should there. That is a priority. So if we're renovating or we're building space, it is a priority to make it accessible. So thank you for expressing your views on this. And
thanks a lot.
I share them.
Hi.
Okay, we'll take two more. I think we're...
Yeah.
And you'll get to speak, so just hang in there for a second round.
Thank you.
Sorry, is that a first time there? Okay, we'll do these three, and then we'll stop. So back you go, but we'll get there.
Hi, my name is Lisa Spanierman. I'm in educational and counseling psychology. I'm new to the McGill community. I arrived in August after 8 years at the University of Illinois, and it's been a very nice welcome here, so thank you for that. And I'm delighted to see this initiative really front and center at the campus. I've studied racism, oppression, and privilege for 14 years, and I'm just very pleased. I didn't really know what to expect on the campus, so it's just delightful to hear many of the students come up and talk about their perspectives and their responses. I'm very appreciative of the work. So in the spirit of collaboration, one of the things that I think we could consider as a campus, the preeminent universities who are doing work on diversity, such as University of Michigan, for example, they're deeply engaged in difficult dialogues. So the young woman who said that, oppression, discrimination, racism, sexism, heterosexism, and the like were left out in the language, I certainly understand some people respond to those terms as they feel attacked and accused, and my research focuses on dominant group members and the reactions to that. But at the same time, if we leave it out, we are perpetuating inadvertently some of the structures of oppression that are already deeply entrenched in the systems. And I don't know enough about the systems here. I don't know enough about the Canadian context, so I don't want to overstep my bounds. And I hope to be researching this, and I hope to find an active group of students to help me research it on the campus. But I just wanted to put that out there and hope we can engage in difficult dialogues together.
We must. Right, and I absolutely encourage that, and I think as a university, having fora like you'll create and are creating where we can do that in the academic context and in a fact-based way, as well as understanding people's subjective experience, and I think we were all a little taken aback to see the results of the survey and the extent to which people feel there's discrimination. So I absolutely don't believe we should shy away from language. We will have many, many fora, I hope forever, that will be candid and open. What we tried to do, though, was to create a set of recommendations that would engage the whole community and not start with a defensive stance, but start with a commitment to progress. And what you're talking about is one element of how we move things forward, but it is not the main event. Okay, so I think that's a way to think about it. And you could take several other modalities and say they will be important as well to making progress as a university, and we hope we have a whole array of modalities that are engaged. But it's wonderful to welcome you as a new colleague and to know that you're leading in scholarship in this important area. Thank you.
Hi, my name is Joël Pedneux. I'm doing my BA in sociology here at McGill. So my question is pretty simple, but it has some pretty big implications. So here goes. My question is, have you personally discussed the issue of tuition increases with or people who have upper-level administration functions in financial institutions, knowing that if tuition fees go up, it means that people have to, or students have to get further into debt and, you know, banks profit off of the interest?
In fact, we do have information, and we have had conversations in that regard. Of course, the Quebec Loan Program sets a framework for that. That I think can bring some comfort to you. But it is an area that we will want to be proactive about. And again, look at the whole set of contributions to providing financial support, and loans should not be the only element of that support.
But my question was, did you personally talk to people from financial institutions?
I have spoken right up to the level of CEO of many of the major banks of Canada about exactly this issue.
Thank you.
Okay. Hello, Kevin Whitaker, Minaka.
Still.
I was just reviewing the list of the members, the 25 mm-hmm. members that were selected, and as you indicated in your response to my first question, that you handpicked these people yourself.
With consultation.
Okay. Then I would just like to know if you can give myself and certainly the 1,600 employees that I represent some indication as to why there was, for instance, a friend of McGill who, this Douglas McDougall, who was an associate.
An alumnus.
Okay. Over representation from the support staff. Yes.
So let me say again, we have a lot of employee groups, and there are many that aren't represented on that. Mr. McDougall, who is an alumnus, has been actively involved in the issue of advancing physical access on the campuses, and that's why he, in particular, was invited to come in.
And again, from my first part, what consciously made you choose that you were not going to approach
That wasn't the conscious choice.
Okay.
I didn't line up the employee groups and say we're going to get input from every one of those in the membership, but everybody was invited to make input to it.
So you're saying consciously no employee groups were?
Correct.
Okay.
Correct.
Thank you.
Correct. Thank you all very much for this very rich and diverse set of comments and questions. And I want to thank Colleen Cook again, Dean Cook, for your welcome and that to your team and to the students we've disrupted. These are all really important inputs to our deliberations. And I, like you, feel we could use more of these. We'll work to do them where we can. Thank you so much for coming out today.